Let me ask them then.
Okay. This is an interview with Sam D. Fawcett at his home in Mebane on the 13th of June, 1995, about the White Furniture Factory. Mr. Fawcett, if you could just begin a little bit with your own family background, where you were born, what your father did.
Well, I was born on 3rd Street in Mebane. In 1917, and at that time my father was working at and had been working at the White Furniture Company since about 1906. And on the other, well, my family has been in the county since before the Revolution, the Fawcetts, and my mother was a Trollinger, who had family had been in the country before the Revolution, too. They were from Hall River, and my father was from the southern part of Alamance. I don't know why you needed to know that, but you asked me what you needed to know.
All these sorts of things are very interesting, actually. So all the details you want to offer, we're interested in listening.
Well, as far as my background, I have a brother who is very much into genealogy, and that's why I could tell you that. Same way with the Trollingers, and by the way, I think Washington Duke's mother was either a Trollinger or kin to the, related to the Trollingers, and she is buried over at Hall River, which was settled by my family and is observing its 250th anniversary this year. I mean, the little town of Hall River up here.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that I was going to say.
Okay.
And I am known to talk too much, so if I'm doing that, just tell me.
Okay.
You can use whatever you want with it.
Great. So, your dad had been working at White's since 1906.
Yeah.
What do you remember about growing up around the fact that you were only a few blocks from...
About four blocks from the factory. Mm-hmm. Well, I remember taking his lunch sometimes. Mama would fix it. They would have an hour for lunch. And by the way, when I was growing up and in early school, they worked from 7 till 12, and then from 1 till 6, and sometimes on Saturday. So they had long work weeks. But it was a small town, and about everyone knew everyone else, and the Whites lived over on 5th Street, and down the old fella, Will White, who was the daddy of the White Furniture Company, you know what I mean, the one that established it, he and his brother, lived on Main Street right across from the factory. But the old fellow himself had a little two-room building at the end of where the last business building between town and the factory.
Mm.
And he lived in that. That was Will White. I clearly remember, but now I can't tell you whether this, but you'll find this out, of probably already have, that the factory burned down on Christmas Eve in 1923, I think, was 1923. I remember seeing the smoke. I'd been sick, and they wouldn't let me go down to see it. I wasn't but about 6. But, I mean, the other kids were going down and watching it burn, and I didn't get to do that. I just could see the smoke from where I lived down on. Another thing, and I'm just telling you little incidents, as you get older, they will isolate yourself, and every once in a while something will bring up a little incident. I remember when they came home from Whites before that, had paid good bonuses to their employees, and at Christmas, They didn't give any paid vacation or anything like that that I know of, unless it was to the executives, but to the workers it didn't. But on Christmas Eve 1929, what they gave for Christmas was 20% pay cut. I mean, that's what they came home with.
On Christmas?
Christmas, when they closed down. Now, that was a leak. I don't blame them particular, but it was one of the things that, you know, you asked what I remember the incident.
Do you remember when that was? Was that when the Depression came out?
1929, Christmas Eve. I think he closed down on Christmas Eve, for Christmas. And I do remember that a lot of times during the Depression. Now, later on, I worked there, and Mr. Sam White, who was president at the time, I worked there from about 1939 till 1947. He said what had happened to him. They'd put all the eggs in one basket, had a sales agent who was taking their full production, and they hadn't scattered it out. And so when business quit with him, they just about shut down. I've known them to go for a month or more without hitting the liquor work. But that was during the Depression time. But then about 1934, they started working full-time again. And 40 hours at that time. Mm-hmm. I recall Depression because, you know, you recall hard times. the whole town of Mabin suffered, not because of whites, but we had about three industries there, and the other one was what is now Kingsdown Bedding Company. I think it was Mabin Royal at one time. But it's always been the bedding factory as far as we're concerned. And then there was a yarn mill. There had been hosier mills, but they shut down when the Depression hit real hard. But this was, I don't know that it was what the name of the yarn mill was then, but it was Rockfish maybe later, and it's there now.
So as a young man in Mabin, when you first started to look for work, where did you go and what did you find?
Burlington. Well, that's where I started looking for it. Now, I eventually wound up, and I got out of school in 1934, but I went to work in 1933 after I got out of school in May. They had 8 months school and 11 years at that time. And I worked at Baker Mabin Hosier Mill and learned to operate knitting machines. The first week, and this was in 1933, before the NRA come in. The NRA was in the National Recovery Act, and I expect, being a historian, you will know that. But in July, I worked all night except actually from 6 till 6, and I got a half hour off at midnight, and I made $4 first week. It sounds ridiculous, don't it? When you go out, and a lot of places pay $4 for a hamburger.
And what was the impact of the NRA? Why do you remember the coming of the NRA?
Well, this was National Recovery Act under President Roosevelt. All of the mills had been operating two shifts, the ones that had got started back, and they were beginning to start up, and machinery was, some of it rusting, things like that. In a knit machine, you can't have rust and have a knit machine, or I imagine looms, but I didn't know that much about looms at that time. I don't know a lot about it now, but why I remember it is because of the hours we were working, and the National Recovery Act put you on 8 hours a shift. And they set the minimum wage for a learner, which I was still considered a learner, because it takes a little while to get enough skill at that time in making us, that would be including the Industrial Revolution and instead of maybe with whites, but at that time they had a 220 or 240 needle machine. You put a sock top, they made the sock tops and they had little transfer lines, you call it. But anyway, you put them on a round bunch of a circle of 220 or 40 according to the size of the machine, and transferred that from the machine, I mean from the transfer, you ravel it down to where just one little thread around each point, and they were kind of hollowed out, and you set that on top of the machine. They had to all fit, and then you pull that, reached up in the machine, pulled that top down, and then started the machine. There's a lot, they wouldn't think about doing that now. things got so automated, but this is some of the instances I remember, but mainly because of cutting down of hours and increase in pay. By the end of summer, I had become a knitter and could make, I could earn the $12 and did get the $12 a week. But I worked a little while after I would work on the second shift. I'd go to school, walk over to the hosier mill that was run at that time, which was 8 or 10 blocks, and worked till 12 o'clock. And I didn't hold up under it. I mean, I was young, but I had 2 miles to walk home by myself and in the dark. But anyway, I worked a month and quit and went ahead and finished school. And, but now jobs were still hard to get after school, and that's when I didn't get on at Maven right off after school was out. So I went to Burlington, went to work in a hosier mill there, and then later I did work back at the same hosier mill in Maven. But what I'm saying about this, you just didn't... they didn't have a job for everybody to come along in. If they could get a experience, I mean, if some experience never came by, they could, they'd, you know, take your application, put you on a list, and then when they could use you, they'd call you. But the same thing applied to most of the work. That was a factor too, for that matter. And of course, there's been lots of changes in the way they operate. Well, there was from a time. I can remember about my father working there, and when I went down there, they had put in an upholstery department, and I was fortunate enough to go to work in it from the beginning. Now, they very seldom transferred anybody from the lumber part to the upholstery because the upholsterers made more money than the others. But of course it must have been kind of hard for a lot to learn. A lot of young people would come in over in the upholstery department in the late 30s, long before the World War started, World War II, and they wouldn't stay long. They wanted to make good money right from the beginning. What was good money to us? And but the whites had a good line of upholstery, but in 1937 they closed it out. After the war.
Now, did your father help you get that job since he was already in
no,
there?
No, he didn't. Like most fathers, they want better for the children if they can get it, and he never did encourage me to go to work at White. Later on, now he had been a veneer cutter, which was pretty much a skilled job, and during the war he was a foreman in the veneer department. But the foreman had went into the army, and then when the war was over he came back, and so Papa was kind of put down there in his older later years to running a dryer, which was about the worst job in there. You had terrible heat to put up with. So one of my brothers who was working at Hall River got him a job up there as an oiler, and that was a job they give the older men up there, and he could do this job and make time. Where at White's, you just worked all the time. And of course, in the upper department, we were on piecework.
So you said, you started 1939, you said, down there?
I started in 39.
39, yeah. Right. And how many people were working at the plant then? Do you remember?
I think there was 300. Now, that was an approximation. It varied a little. They also had a plant in Hillsboro. You probably heard of that. And I never did know exactly how many they worked there, but not any. This was the main plant, and that was, I don't know what, Satellite, I reckon. Mm-hmm. Satellite.
So you'd been in the plant before you first went to
Yes, I'd been in there at lunchtime. Well, they generated their own electricity, but at lunchtime, at 12 o'clock, it would switch over to Duke Power just to have lights in the plant. Huh. But they had a boiler room, and even I expect up until they closed it out, they probably.
Didn't know that.
But they did. They of course, they utilized the scraps and sawdust and stuff like that. They didn't have to have a sawdust pile, nothing. It went through the blower system, right? Now, that's when I was down there, that had the boiler that made electricity all of it. Ever since they built a new one, anyway. And, but it was a pretty fair place to work. They never paid, unless it was maybe later, you know, if I didn't know anything about it. But,
they never paid
top wages.
Top wages, I see.
They paid pretty good, but they always encourage you. Old man Sam's main topic in the Christmas speech he would always make was to buy yourself a little piece of land and a cow. In other words, they encourage you to have the garden, and it wasn't a bad place to work. I mean, there wasn't slave drivers or anything like that.
And so you started in the upholstery and stayed in the upholstery?
I stayed in the upholstery. I started and learned what they did it in parts. So what I learned when I first went in was to put the outsides on and trim. You know, where they have wooden rails, you would glue gimp over the tack line, you know, right up to the rail. And gimp was a little braid, and or you would put gimp down and then dry brass head nails, and they used a lot of them. And they had a lot of sofas and chairs that were trimmed in wood. They didn't make these frames. Now, later on at Hillsboro, they made the frames for that plant, but they didn't make the ones for the Maven plant. They had a side, now I think rails are still on the back side, but I don't know whether across the highway or not. But the freight would come in on there, and then on the back side of the plant, the railroad come right up to where they could just unload and, you know, put a metal piece down. But the frames would come, you know how they used to ship automobiles and freight cars?
No, I don't.
Well, there would be about six or eight, and where you see them hiked up on the trailers now, they would have them blocked up. I mean, they were made, they were fast, but the frames would come, it'd be a car, box car load of upholstery frames come from Halpern in the company in Philadelphia. And that was, they were supposed to make good. They had some Victorian stuff, and they had a really top line of upholstery. Hmm. And later on, as I got out of there and seen I started upholstering on my own. But I was, you know, would be around in the plants in the High Point, and I found out that I was glad that I learned to do this at White's, because of the quality of theirs above most of the plants in the High Point. But it was...
Now, do you know why they got out of upholstery at that time? 1947?
Well, in 1947, the demand, the supply kind of caught up with the demand. And... upholsterers in general at that time were drifters. Now, that don't mean everybody. I wasn't. I stayed in Mabin. But Steve Millender was vice president, one of the vice presidents at that time, and I've been told this, that he drank beer up at a beer joint where one of the upholsterers was, and he was kind of high, and we were on short time, first short time we'd had, and he was telling me he had to have more time. You know, as you go older, you find out, of course, I wasn't involved in that part, but that was one of the things, he sounded off to him, and he just decided to close it out. He and the board did, rather than fool with it. But also, I've heard this, and check with other people if you're going to check with. I don't know that it was a reason. I just know we got a letter saying at such and such a date that they would be closed out. And but organized a union down there in the upholstery department. Although we were making better, we thought it would be a help to the others, and I don't recall ever trying to organize anybody from the other side, but I did join the union, but practically all of the upholstery department joined it. And so I think from the management we probably got credit for it being there. Now, this was back a while when we were still at war, and what happened, they didn't want to negotiate, and they had several negotiating. I wasn't on the negotiating committee, but the president told us at the meeting that they just wouldn't negotiate, and, you know, in good faith, you might say, and the War Labor Board come somewhere in between what we were asking and what they were demanding, and told both sides to sign it. So for a while that did that helped things considerably. Helped the not for the company, at least they never was satisfied with it, and later on they, when they didn't have to, they did negotiate in the union. I don't know whether it was voted out or whether it just faded away.
Yep.
But they thought getting rid of, I was told they thought getting rid of the upholstery department would help their cause in that respect.
Well, do you remember whether that union was AFL or CIO?
Well, it was AFL-CIO, but it was... Furniture Workers of America.
Furniture Workers of America.
United, I think, Furniture Workers of America, something like that.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, at that time, the AFL and the CIO were separate, and I was just wondering whether they joined in the 50s.
Oh, wow, it was CIO.
It was a CIO, yeah.
I think sometime along about that time is when they became affiliated, but I know we started out as CIO.
Interesting. Do you know how the whole union ball got rolling? Were the folks from outside, or
well,
was
actually,
it into the plant?
I'm sure that folks from outside must have contacted. But Charlie Williams was the first union president, and he was, you know, representative in the negotiations. All of course, he had others with him. But now he was from a machine room, or the cabinet room, I'm not positive which, on the other side. It didn't start in the upholstery department, but we felt that it would be a help to them. I know that's why we joined. We didn't, there was some things that, we were on piecework, for instance, and it only affected a few, but when they'd go to take inventory or something like that, in a cloth room, somebody that was on piecework and could make good money, if they had some hour work for them, they would pay a minimum wage. And we brought that up to where they'd get an average of what they made. And I say we, by having the union done it, it was stopped the shop stewards. But I was trying to think of the other officers, and I know Charlie Williams was what, we had a man from the International that was down there and helped organize it. But I don't know whether somebody called him to come in or he contacted somebody in the factory, but the company was very anti-union as far as that was concerned.
Now,
is this the kind of stuff you want?
This is exactly what I'm looking for. This is right out of the
money. Well, you just go ahead and ask, and I'll keep talking.
Well, you said we were earlier on, you said we were making better. Did you mean the upholsterers were making better money than folks in the rest of the plant? Or
The upholsterers made better money. Not because they wanted to pay better money, but because to get upholsters back even before the war started, they had to pay a better price to get experienced upholsters come in. And
because other plants were hiring away upholsterers?
Well, upholsters, I suppose if you go to High Point, you'll find that even today upholsters make above the people that, I mean, make more money than the people that make the frames and make the case goods, as we call it.
It's a little higher skilled work?
I think it's a skill. It takes longer to learn it than, you can go in a machine room and if they put you to tailing, what they call tailing the machine, is on the end where you take it off and put it on trucks. And the other end is feeding. And, of course, there'll be a skilled man that sets the machine up for whatever operation they're doing. But the man on the back end will make less than the man on the front end.
Okay, so the upholstery shop was still sort of the center of union activity, is the impression I'm getting?
It wasn't the center. It was just the strongest.
The strongest within the plant.
We were the, about everybody in the upholstery belonged to the union. I mean, went ahead and joined it.
As opposed to the folks over case goods and the
others
rest.
Were more, well, they were more divided, what I mean.
Now,
there were some over there that were stronger, really, than we were, but others that, and I know one fella came to the union hall, came to the meeting, and had a rented union hall. And actually, he joined, and then after they got the union going and got the contract, he became a foreman over in the machine room. He was a spy, a mole that was put in there to see what we were doing. Of course, there was no law against it that I know of, but he was kind of coming in under false, like he was interested in it. But I imagine you have that in all of them. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that. these are little incidents, though, that I can recall from this.
Yeah, so you actually did get a signed contract when the War Labor Board...
During the war, and as far as I know, they never got another one. Don't remember how long this was for. It was more than a year. But it did improve working conditions. For instance, when my father worked down in... and this was at the time I was working there, too. There'd be, say, three men here on the bench doing the same thing. And it was at the foreman's discretion, and I'm sure he had to clear it with other people. Some of them would be making 40, some 60, and some 80. I mean, three men doing the same thing, they would pay them whatever they decided to pay them. I reckon it's a little bit given. We got job ratings. I mean, that was one of the things we got in the contract.
I see. Classifications.
Now, I say we and them, but I don't have any bitterness towards whites because really I got, you would have to know something about the times to realize what I'm, and you probably do from being a historian. To break out of the mold of just working in there, to give me a chance to learn a trade, and then I was able to take advantage. Of course, now, when I went to work there, I already had three, was the father of three children. So I was hungry. not really hungry, you understand, but I was hungry for some of the better things in life. And so after they closed down, I built this building. I built the building myself, started an upholstery shop.
This one right here behind us?
This one over here. And built it, actually the carpenter work. But you done things like that back then to get ahead. Mm-hmm. And... like I say, I'm not bitter at them, and as far as I know, they weren't at me. There's one man I didn't like, but there was superintendent, but I like his son, and he's dead and gone now, so we won't go into that. But that was Fonce Bean, as among the he was superintendent. But they said that Steve Millender was a hard man, but you could believe Steve Millender. I mean, he might have been a hard man, but he was a truthful man. And Steve White, now, I had the feeling that he would come around and grin and pat you on the back, but I always had the feeling he might have a knife. And, now, I don't know whether you understand what I mean there, but
I did.
I don't have any thing to prove that. Well, I do have one thing, too, but it doesn't prove that. It makes me more sure. But while I was building this place, the first time in my life, I drew, and it was $20 a week for about, I drew it for about 8 or 9 weeks.
Drew, I'm sorry, unemployment? Or?
Unemployment, while I was building this building out here. And I didn't have enough work to keep me busy to begin with, so I went to work in Graham whenever they needed me at a postal place. One day a deputy sheriff came in and served a warrant on me. It was for drawing... I'd already quit. I went to work, and it just happened, I think, that what saved me when I worked up there something and drew that money, I reported it the next week when you had to go in and sign for a check every time then. And they would deduct that from, I'll deduct some from what you drew.
I see.
But anyway, I was supposed to... been drawing work unemployment money while I was working, and they'd come by and seen me working on the building, and I'm sure that either Steve White or Mr. Bean, one was the one turned it in. But then when I went for a hearing before a magistrate, I wasn't put in jail or anything like that. I was just, you know, had to recognize that the warrant was served on me. And,
but you were working for your own?
I was working for another upholster, a little small guy running a reupholster shop in Graham.
I see. So it wasn't just, you work on your own shop over here?
When I was working, building the shop, it just happened. And that was what said that I was building the shop. But when we went before the magistrate, Steve White was there, and he was, you know, like I say, he was friendly. He'd just come and I knew that they were the ones that were behind it, but I believe he just had come, said he came to confirm. I was talking with him about the fact he came and sat down beside me when we was waiting for the hearing, and there was a man from the labor board there. But when the magistrate heard it, he asked him, said, "Oh, what about a farmer here that is not working on his job and is building a barn?" They said, "Oh, that's different." He said, "I don't see the difference." And he marked it not guilty on the warrant. I mean, just wrote that on it, and the War Labor Board man tried to argue with him. He said, I've passed judgment on it." So he didn't get anywhere with it, but you remember these little things. And, you know, people are inhuman to each other. I mean, they'll do little things to get back at you for something you think maybe, you know, that you think maybe they've done to you or something. And I just thought this was uncalled for.
What was his motivation? He didn't want to see you opening up another shop?
No, it wasn't that. It wouldn't have been in competition with him, because this was to reupholster furniture at that time. Because I didn't have any money. I couldn't have possibly, you know, I wouldn't have been drawing $20 a week unemployment. Well, that was the only unemployment I ever drew was for the, I think, 9 weeks. And this had been several months before that. I had got through out here and I started the upholstering shop, but I still had to go work a day or two here and there to live.
I guess I still don't understand why he would do that to you.
You can't understand it.
You don't know.
I mean, I don't know the motive. I don't remember ever. Of course, now, I was a union member, and I think Mr. Bean must have held grudges and wanted to be the cheese, but I won't say that part of that. This is what I think.
Okay. That's fine.
And Steve White thought he would cause me a little trouble because I didn't catch that to him either. But that was one of the incidences that I remember about this.
You suggested that there were a couple possible reasons why the upholstery shop at White's shut down. One was an economic reason, the other was the union.
One was I really think them would be the two. And I don't know, you know, I can't go into your mind and find out what you're thinking. And of course, I'm going to tell you mainly what I'm thinking, but right on the other hand, there might be something that I don't want to do that I just don't mention.
Sure.
But I try to be open about this. I mean, it's not anything, it means a thing to me now. But now, Bernie Bean works at Crafty, and that's Fonce's son. He later was Alphonse's assistant down there, but he was just a boy when I was down there. And if he'd his father come over in that department, he'd run hiding the sofa. I reckon his daddy didn't want him, you know, just hanging around there. Well, I mean, hiding the sofa, he'd get in one out of the back, and so he couldn't see him. But I think Bernie's a right good fellow.
So there was never, I'm continuing with the theme of the union, there were never any strikes or walkouts, I take it?
Not that I know of. Okay.
And what do you think prevented, everyone from getting behind the union? Why do you think?
Well, they worked so hard against it.
The company.
And I've been told that Steve White would pay off the international representatives. I don't know that that's true either. This is just hearsay. But I do know that they didn't work as much openly as they did undercover. All the time it was in, they were strongly against it.
Right. But from the perspective of the workers over in the case goods production, I'm just wondering how they might
were divided. There was a majority of them for the union, but I know later on, after I was out here, it was quite a few years, the union tried to get another contract, and there was about 75% voted for the union that time, which was more than to begin with, but they never got the contract. And I've heard that it was because Steve White paid off the
international.
In other words, unless international backs, just no,
right.
No little place union is strong enough to strike. You know, you don't make that much money. you can do it. And what I mean, in outlast the company, but with an international backing you, which is what they're supposed to do, but. Mm-hmm. You find crooked people in all walks of life.
Sure do. Do you know when that second attempt to bring the union in might have been?
It was in the late 60s or early 70s. I'm not positive now of the date of that because it was something that, you know, just people that I knew from down there would tell me. Now, I had dealing that wasn't not with Steve White. Steve Millender was also sales manager. And later on, after a while, after several years of upholstering, we started selling furniture. And it's hard to get a line of good furniture in a new store. But, and why I say it's hard, because all the established dealers don't want no new dealers. And, but now that's industry talk there. What I mean, mm-hmm. It's not just one company.
Mm-hmm.
And so a fellow that thinks he's just going to go and start in the furniture business, go anywhere and get any line, can't do it. But one of the salesmen who was Steve Millender's brother-in-law came by here one day. I had to ask about it, and got a negative, and I was crazy enough to just go down there and go up in Steve Millender's office and ask him about it. But he just kind of beat around the bush that time. But later on, his brother-in-law stopped in, Father Jones, and said he thought we ought to have that. Well, at that time, we had already got Craftique and Kings down, two local companies. If I hadn't have been able to get them, I would never got going without any money to start up. But we sold a lot of Craftique, and when it was at its, well, before it was sold out, sold to Pulaski.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we'd buy what they would call two truck loads at a time. They delivered in their own truck, which was big truck. But we were one of the best dealers, right? Because we always got fair treatment from, and from Kings Down too.
Did you ever get any white furniture then?
Yes, we did. But I never did do too good with it, because if it got started, I think I could. Because, you know, everybody didn't have it, but we done well enough with the ones that we did get. We get the Bob Timberlake. Of course, we were getting Lexington furniture all the time. I mean, for a long time. And I don't know what they know and have other interests, but Bob Timberlake is a artist in North Carolina, and he went to Thomasville and designed some reproduction furniture, and it Lexington has 14 plants, and it run three of them for 2 years on that one little line. I mean, Lexington is a big furniture producer. Well, it's still running one plane, I think, full time.
And what was?
I don't mean to get away from white. You'll have to.
That's fine. I'll steer you back as need be. As a furniture dealer, what is the reputation of White's products?
White's had a good, very good reputation. I've always felt that they started going backwards when Mr. Bean came in as superintendent. We had a trying to think of the man's name. It was superintendent when I worked down there. Well, I was down there when he left and Mr. Bean came in. I can't.